I just wanted to share with you some of my impressions and reflections about the Christian community in China. A year ago this past March, my wife and I and one of our children had the opportunity to travel with a group of a total of 15 people, all but one of them Lutherans, all stationed in Hong Kong. I was in Hong Kong at the time on part of my sabbatical, teaching at the Lutheran Seminary there in Sha Tin in the New Territories. And a group of Lutherans from Hong Kong, Americans, Canadians, Norwegians, Finns, and Germans, got together under the leadership of David Vickner, Jr., who holds the Far East desk for the Lutheran World Federation. And together we traveled for 2 weeks in the People's Republic of China with an express focus on and an interest in the life of the church there. And we had a chance to meet with church leaders in a number of places in the PRC and to understand something of the work of reconstruction that is going on there at the present time. So I'd like to share with you some of these impressions. I don't claim to be any expert. In fact, the general rumor is that the only people more boring than people who have just come back from the People's Republic of China who think therefore they know everything and are looked at as experts are people who have just returned from the Soviet Union. Now, I said that last week when I made this presentation, and one of Elmer Witt's sons was here, just returned from the Soviet Union, so I shouldn't have said that. I should have checked it out with him first. But I did want to share with you some of these impressions and show a few slides a little later on. I regret that in our haste in packing, I grabbed the set of slides that are usually set for church groups and seminaries and so forth, and I had rearranged them, and so a fair number of the slides that I wanted to show you, including the Easter service at St. Paul's Church in Nanjing and some of the other seminaries, particularly in Guangzhou, and especially pictures. I was interested in taking pictures of children and older people. Those are not here, but the slides that I do have, I'll let you take a glimpse at some of them. Perhaps the best place to begin is to just reflect about something of Christian history in this very ancient, very rich, very intriguing culture. The first impact of Christians goes back to the year 635. When Christian missionaries from Persia traveled along the Silk Route, which stretches from the city of Xi'an, which is still there in the western part of China, all the way into Persia and then beyond, getting all the way to Constantinople. And that was a great trade route, and it's called the Silk Road. And Christian missionaries who were Nestorian Christians traveled there in the 7th century, and they witnessed to the gospel, and they had a hearing. But by the end of about the year 900, all traces of Nestorian Christianity had disappeared, with the exception of a stone tablet, which still exists and is in the collection of royal tablets in the city of Xi'an. And I have a slide of that a little later on. And there it talks about the coming of the strange religion and a little bit about it. And that was the first Christian impact on China. But they disappeared. Then Marco Polo showed up at the time of the court of Kublai Khan, when a Mongol dynasty had established its foothold over China. And quickly following on the heels of Marco Polo, Franciscans journeyed from Europe and established again a Christian mission, and met with some interest and success in the court of Kublai Khan. But a century later, in effect, all traces of that Christianity also disappeared. Time went on, and then finally, in the year 1601, several Jesuits, reaching out into the Far East under the leadership of Francis Xavier, bringing Christianity to India, China, and Japan, journeyed into China and began to establish a mission there. The leading figure among them was Matteo Ricci. we had the experience of being able to visit the grave of Matteo Ricci in Beijing. It had been on what was then the site of a Roman Catholic seminary. And Matteo Ricci's grave had been moved to the middle of those seminary grounds. In the Cultural Revolution, that property was confiscated, taken away from the Roman Catholic Church, and was made into a training center for government cadres, we would say the civil service. So Chinese civil servants are being trained in the buildings where Chinese used to be trained as Roman Catholic priests. And in the middle of the courtyard is the grave of Matteo Ricci. One of the interesting things is that we were there on the festival of Qingming, which is a festival in the spring in which the Chinese honor their ancestors. And now under the leadership of the communist government, it is a time when Chinese are asked to honor their great, not necessarily their blood ancestors, but their spiritual ancestors. And so we thought it was really profoundly appropriate that this little band of Christians wandered into the midst of this campus training communist government cadres in order to pay our respects at the grave of Matteo Ricci, this Jesuit missionary who brought Christianity in a more modern period, in the very beginning of the 17th century. Matteo Ricci had a proposal very early on. He said that Christianity must become indigenous. Christianity must become Chinese in its form, even though it remains faithful in its substance to the tradition. But that the Western forms of Christianity must give place to indigenous Chinese forms. And so he recommended the use of Chinese elements and symbols in worship, that priests wear the same gowns as either Chinese scholars or else Chinese priests, that Chinese music and art be incorporated. And this proposal of Ricci's was repudiated. There was a great rivalry at that time in Rome between the Jesuits and the Franciscans, and the Franciscans got to the ear of the Pope. Matteo Ricci's proposal was declared heretical, and as a result, Roman Catholic presence from then on in China has been thoroughly and totally Western. And you'll see a picture of the Roman Catholic Cathedral in Beijing, and you can just tell from the look of it precisely how triumphant this uninformed and insensitive response has been. Almost every single Christian church that we were in China looks as if it could be picked up from the middle of France or Germany or Iowa or Detroit and just dropped in the middle of China. It looks thoroughly and totally Western. The only Chinese-designed churches that we saw, there are several here and there, but the most Chinese-looking churches that we ever saw that were totally Chinese in character were two Lutheran churches in Hong Kong, both of which were designed by Olaf Skisnes, a Norwegian-American doctor who was the offspring of medical missionaries in China. And he designed these Chinese-looking buildings, and they were built now in Hong Kong as Lutheran churches. And then one more at the top of Daofengshan Mountain, where I lived at the foot of Daofengshan Mountain in Hong Kong. At the top of the mountain is a Lutheran monastery for Buddhists. That sounds a little strange, but that's what it is. It's a monastery that was a Buddhist monastery built by a Norwegian Lutheran missionary in the earlier part of the century for the sake of Christian-Buddhist dialogue and to witness to the gospel to Buddhists. He was a very accomplished Buddhist scholar, a great expert in the Buddhist sutras, and it is in a typical fashion of a Buddhist monastery, and Zen monks traveling through China would come to this monastery, and everything around them would be totally familiar. It is totally Chinese. It is totally Buddhist. And up there over the altar, in typical Chinese form, is a saying from the sutras. But over on the other side, there is another saying, which is from the New Testament. And their worship services, they would read selections from the Buddhist scriptures, and then they would read the Christian scriptures, and then they have interpretation of the Christian scriptures. And right now, of course, the opportunity of Buddhist monks to come across the border has been curtailed, but there is now at the present time a Chinese congregation there with a Chinese pastor who was one of those Zen Buddhist monks who came to that monastery and stayed and became a Christian, and now is a Lutheran pastor there with a Christian congregation at Dao Feng Shan. That, of course, also is totally in the Chinese architectural style, and the symbolism is all Chinese. There's a Chinese altar table and all that sort of thing. Could someone see if we could have that noise turn up? Do you know what that noise is? Thank you. Well, all of that, going back to Matteo Ricci, who called for an indigenous Chinese church, a church that really tried to communicate itself in respecting the authenticity and the significance of Chinese culture, but ignored. Finally, Robert Morrison, the first Protestant missionary, coming to the Hong Kong-Macau area in 1807, from Great Britain, the first Protestant presence in China. And following Morrison throughout the 19th century, the greatest influx of Protestant missionaries in any one single mission field in modern Christian history. Christians from Europe and from North America poured in personnel and financial resources. They built huge institutions. They built universities, medical colleges. They established seminaries and Bible training institutes. They had this grand impact and investiture of time, energy, personnel, and money. And then, of course, came the Chinese-Japanese War, which again then developed, as you know, into the Second World War. Missionaries, in many instances, were interned, or else they fled with the national or with the Chinese up into the hills to the east, and to the west. And then, of course, 1945, Japan was defeated, and then soon after, Chiang Kai-shek's troops moved against the communists with whom they had an alliance, and they slaughtered tens of thousands of communists, and the communists then gathered their remnants together and took the great long march into the north, where they rebuilt their forces, and then they opposed the nationalist army and defeated the nationalist army, driving the nationalists across the sea into the island of Taiwan, where they are to this day. Then on October 1st of 1949, Mao Zedong stood, and you'll see the picture of this, Mao Zedong stood at the great entrance gate to the Forbidden City in Beijing, the Imperial City, and there from that balcony he announced the formation of the People's Republic of China. That, of course, meant something very significant, because it was the proclamation of the establishment of a Marxist atheistic state. The Constitution, however, of the People's Republic of China did theoretically guarantee religious freedom. Missionaries were of a mixed mind. Many of them left. As the nationalist Chinese left, the Christian missionaries, Roman Catholic and Protestant, also left. Some did stay on, but they soon found that they were being forced to leave. And finally, by the early 1950s, not one single Western missionary was left in China, with the exception of one Danish woman who had become a Chinese citizen and who lived and worked and ministered until she died. But outside of that, all Western influence was gone. There was no more support from the West, no more financial support. The Chinese Christians were on their own. At that time, when the Chinese Christians were left on their own, there were about 3 million Roman Catholics in China, and they had about 4,700 priests originally, and they lost 2,000 of them who were Westerners. So they had 2,700 native Chinese priests left behind. The Protestants numbered about 700,000. About three quarters of a million Protestant Christians. There again, the number of pastors was such that half of them, I don't have the figures in front of me now, but half of them were Chinese. So only half of the pastors left were Chinese, with about 750,000 Protestants. Then there was a major crisis on the part of both the Chinese Roman Catholics and the Chinese Protestants, who then and still to this day are completely independent of one another. It's one of the sad things that one encounters in China, that Roman Catholics and Protestants don't have any contact with one another. The whole ecumenical movement has not touched them. Just like with the Roman Catholics, the whole of Vatican II has not touched them. They still celebrate Mass in Latin. They still have the altar up against the back wall. The priest still faces the altar with his back to the people. It is still pre-Vatican II Roman Catholicism. But they have no contact with Protestants. Protestants have no contact with Roman Catholics. And the Chinese population as a whole considers them as two separate religions. In China, you are either a Catholic or a Christian. I mean, if you're a Christian, it means you're not a Roman Catholics are not Christians in China, put it that way. And the reason is that the Protestants were so antagonistic toward the Roman Catholics that when they came to China, they purposely chose different Chinese terms to translate traditional Christian terminology into Chinese. So Roman Catholics and Protestants have totally different words for God. And key terms, the Protestants chose alternative terms because they didn't want to be confused with being Roman Catholic. So the Protestants caused this sense of a profound differentiation in the minds of the Chinese people. Then the question was, how will the church then establish itself and live out its life in a communist, atheistic state? What happened was the development of the so-called three-self movement in 1950. The official name was the Three-Self Patriotic Association. And this was a pan-Protestant movement that tried to indicate its commitment was to the upbuilding of the life of the Chinese people. It did not understand itself to be subversive or hostile to the government or to Chinese culture. Now this was a major issue because up until this time, Christianity, not only in the impressions of the Chinese people, but of the way in which it actually lived out its life, was thoroughly westernized in character. Chinese people thought of Christianity as a Western religion. This wasn't just due to the fact of it was imported from the West, or it was associated with the economic and political domination of China by Western powers, because these people usually tended to associate themselves with Christianity in some form or other. If you know a little bit about Chinese history, you know that in the late 19th century, the Chinese central government was virtually powerless and was dominated economically and politically by the Western powers, who carved up China among themselves and said, we'll have control over this section and you can have control over that. And there were the Western powers: France, Germany, Russia, England, Sweden, the United States, all carving up China for themselves. And most of these people tended to go to church. Therefore, for the Chinese, Christianity is identified with the West and with Western domination and exploitation of China. But even in addition to that, if that isn't enough of an identification of Christianity in China, Chinese citizens who became Christians were allowed to be judged in courts of law that were shaped according to Western law, not Chinese law. They were not subject to the Chinese system of justice. They could appeal to the Western system of justice that was operating there for Western peoples who were there in political or economic roles. And so the Chinese always thought of Christianity as being Western, not being Chinese. And going back to Matteo Ricci, who said we ought to find a Chinese form of Christian identity, the Protestants were not any better. If you go to a Protestant service in China, you discover it's very much like a typical American Protestant Sunday school service, if you know what those were like a generation or so ago. That's the typical Protestant form. No Chinese forms of music used, no Chinese forms of art used. The pictures of Jesus look like the same pictures of Jesus that you have in your Sunday school literature. It's totally alien, has no contact with Chinese culture. So, 1950, a group of Protestant leaders got together and said, let's create this movement to try and communicate and interpret Christianity to the government and to act as a kind of buffer between the Christian community, at least the Protestant community, and the Chinese government. And that's what they did. And hence they call themselves the Three Self Patriotic Movement. Patriotic in the sense that they were saying, we are not Western, we are not alien, we are not hostile, we are here as faithful faithful Chinese who love their country, but we also are Christians and we love our Lord and we are committed to our Lord. And we are going to live out the meaning of this and find our way. The term Three Self refers to their vision of what they felt was their agenda. First of all, they had to be self-supporting. Just by the sheer fact of the case, there was no more Western money coming in. And most of the operations of the Protestant and Roman Catholic communities in China were financed from overseas. They said, we're going to have to raise our own funds. We're going to have to be self-supporting. Secondly, we're going to have to be self-propagating. We as Chinese Christians, accept the task of missionary outreach, of evangelization of the Chinese people. We are not looking to non-Chinese to come in and assist us in this. This is our task. We are the church. We are mission. And thirdly, the third element of why the word self is used, they said, we are self-governing. We are not going to be obedient to missionary boards in Toronto or New York or St. Louis or London or Berlin or anywhere else. We are going to govern our own life. And so they set about trying to reconstruct and maintain church life in China under very adverse and troubling conditions. The church managed to sort of hold on. The seminaries were closed down except for the seminary in Nanjing. Bit by bit, each seminary got closed down. Faculties became consolidated until there was one Protestant seminary in the city of Nanjing. And that continued to turn out just a few pastors each year. That is, up until the Cultural Revolution. Mao had tried various forms of patterns of reform. There was the campaign, Let 100 Flowers Bloom, Let 100 Thoughts Contend, in which Mao and the Communist Party said, we expect diversity, we expect difference of opinion, we want these opinions out in the open, and let's have a good, solid debate, and whatever is the soundest wisdom will then surface. Well, what happened was, it was used as a way to find where all the discontent and the malcontents were, and they were eliminated. Then came the Great Leap Forward, in which they tried to modernize China overnight, and it was a total failure. And then a lot of disillusionment began to set in. And so the leftists, the radicals in the Communist Party, initiated the Great Proletarian Cultural Revolution, which started in 1966 and lasted 10 years. That cultural revolution had a profound effect upon China, a profoundly disruptive and destructive effect that is still being felt today. And we heard great criticism of the Cultural Revolution and encountered the sense of a lot of resentment. What in effect happened? Mao turned to the young people and said, they are going to be the new China, they're going to have the new mentality, they're not tied to an old China or old patterns, and they're going to create a situation of permanent renewal and revolution. And all the middle schools, that is the junior high schools and the senior high schools, and all the colleges and universities and technical schools were closed. For 10 years, the only education that existed in China was basically primary education. These students were then set loose in the streets, And they were encouraged to create change and foment criticism and transformation and the total eradication of any Western or bourgeois thinking and patterning of life. Bizarre and terrible things happened. People lost their lives. Groups of Red Guards actually fought with one another, pitched battles. For example, when we were in Shanghai, we heard how leftist Red Guards came pouring into Shanghai. Shanghai was the birthplace of the Communist Party and was always one of the more radical centers. But there, the children of the working class people in Shanghai were already Red Guards. And then these Red Guards came streaming in elsewhere and said, we need to transform Shanghai. We have to make it more radical. We have to create a people's commune here. And we have to deliver Shanghai into the hands of the people. And these Shanghai Red Guards said, we are the people. We are the Shanghaiese. Our parents are the ones who have struggled. Our parents are the ones who have suffered. And we already are the people. We don't need to have any radical transformation here. We're doing all right. And they said, no, you're not, and so forth. And the result was pitched battles in which people actually lost their lives. In many instances, the People's Liberation Army had to step in order to restore civil order. It was absolute chaos throughout the country. Reversing the traditional Chinese pattern of respect for learning and the traditional Chinese pattern of respect for the elderly. Older people were criticized. They were humiliated. And professors were disgraced. Even people who were interested in playing Western music, their instruments were smashed, they were humiliated, they were driven out into the countryside, and part of the Cultural Revolution was all the intellectuals, all the leaders of the country should be sent out into the countryside to learn from the peasants and to work out in the fields, work in factories, and so forth. And you can imagine now what happened to all the Christian pastors in China and all the church workers in China. They were dispersed. We talked to Alfred Chen, a professor of church history at the seminary in Beijing. He ended up becoming the janitor in the school where he taught and cleaning the toilets. That was his task for 10 years under the Cultural Revolution. And the reason the principal gave him that task was, Alfred, if they see you cleaning toilets, they will think that you're humiliated enough and they won't do anything worse to you. So the principal is actually protecting him. That sort of thing happened all over. Every Christian church, every last Christian church in China was shut down. The property turned over for all kinds of other uses. We saw the great, beautiful Sacred Heart Church in Guangzhou, built in typical French Gothic style. It was used as a garbage collection depot. The Roman Catholic Cathedral in Beijing was used as a warehouse and as a gymnasium for a school. Every last Christian church was confiscated and turned into something else. Every Bible that could be found was burned. Every Christian hymnal that was found was burned. Every piece of Christian literature was destroyed. And Christianity ceased to exist. One could no longer find any traces of Christianity in the whole of China. Everything disappeared. And so that was the state of Christianity, and it sounded as if it was what had happened with the Nestorians and the Franciscans and the Jesuits. Once again, Christianity had entered China, was there for a while, and then disappeared. Then some quiet little things began to happen. There were some Tanzanians who were in Beijing in the diplomatic corps, and they said, we're faithful Christians. We want to worship on Sunday morning. We're Protestants. We're Roman Catholics. We want to go to church on Sunday. And since the Chinese government was courting the Third World, especially at that time, they allowed two churches to open in Beijing, one Roman Catholic church, one Protestant church. And a handful of people would show up, just a few Chinese, because they were very cautious about that. Mostly foreigners came to those churches. And so that was the state of things until 1976. In that year earlier, Zhou Enlai died. He had been a moderating force in the Cultural Revolution, trying to hold the pieces together. And then later on in September, Mao Zedong died. And his self-appointed heirs took power. But Very soon, by October, within a month, Mao's heirs were set aside. New groups, more moderating groups, came to power within the Chinese Communist Party and took control of the government. And that was the initiation of the criticism of the so-called Gang of Four. By the way, when we were there, we heard open criticism of Mao. People were very open about criticizing Mao. The general gist now is Mao was a great revolutionary leader who helped liberate the Chinese people, but he wasn't a very wise governor. But earlier, what they would do is, a few years ago, they would talk about the Gang of Four, and they would open up their whole hand and show five fingers, and you know who the thumb was. So that's how they would indirectly criticize Mao. But now he's criticized directly. A new, more moderate element came to power, and a whole process of liberalization and modernization began, and the effects of that are still being felt. Slowly, surely, things began to change. In 1980, 4 years later, the Nanjing Seminary reopened. They sent out applications. They had an announcement that they would reopen. They had 700 applicants from across China. They gave tests to 350, and they accepted a class of about 80. And that was the first time then a Christian institution of learning opened up and began to train leadership. And this is the major problem with both the Roman Catholic and Protestant communities in China. Their pastors are almost all in their 70s and 80s. There are a few that are in their 60s and 50s, not much beyond that. Bit by bit, churches began to reopen. And now what has happened is something absolutely remarkable, really incredible, beyond anything that could have been anticipated. Churches are now reopening in China at the rate of one a day. The property is being returned to the Christian communities, and for all the properties that were confiscated, the Chinese Communist government is paying both the Roman Catholic and Protestant communities back rent. There has been established now, right near Nanjing University, a new printing plant that has been built. And I'll talk a little bit more about that. It's been sponsored by the Amity Foundation and the World Bible Society. A state-of-the-art West German printing press has been established there. And they have now printed 1 million Bibles. And they're in the process of printing another 3 million. The paper for all those Bibles is being supplied by the Chinese Communist government as compensation for the destruction of Bibles by the Red Guards during the Cultural Revolution. They also have printed, the Protestants have printed a new hymnal. And 500,000 copies of this hymnal have been printed. Again, the paper supplied by the Communist government. This is a new hymnal in which they invited people all over China to submit poems, that is the words, in Chinese form and to write melodies in Chinese traditional style for the new hymnal. 25% of all these hymns now are Chinese. They're totally Chinese in character. And now they are also introducing Chinese religious art. I had a copy of the calendar for 1986 that came from the Three Self-Movement offices. And there you have pictures of Jesus with the disciples and so forth, and the nativity scene and so forth. And everything in it is Chinese. I mean, the people look Chinese. The setting is Chinese. The art form is Chinese. At last there's some response to what Matteo Ricci was calling for back in the early 1600s. What we have also discovered is the Roman Catholic community has grown in this period of time since 1976 when the Cultural Revolution began, 1966, the Cultural Revolution began, from 3 million to 3.5 million. And the Protestant community has grown from 750,000 to 4 million. That's the conservative estimate. There are some estimates that go as high as 20 million. Now that is not only an exaggerated estimate, it also is a confusing one, because many of these people who are considered to be Christians really are not Christians. They're heretical sectarian groups that border close to kind of magic and superstition. Self-proclaimed religious visionaries who even just hear about Jesus, have never been instructed, have never even been baptized, and run around declaring that they can perform healing miracles and gather a flock and so forth, and prey on the rather superstitious tradition of Chinese peasants. So a part of the great problem of the church in China at this time is, first of all, to train pastors and to train congregational leaders and to train Sunday school teachers, the equivalent of that, and catechists, and to train evangelists. And so now at this point, 10 seminaries are now open, Protestant seminaries are now open in China, 10 of them. You'll see pictures of the Beijing seminary. The local pastors are the faculty. Back in Nanjing, that's the national seminary. That's the most intellectually rigorous of the seminaries. The people who come there usually don't have a university or college degree. This is true for all the seminaries. For those who do have university and college training, they are sent to the Nanjing seminary and they have a special course, and they are trained and they are sent out now to be the teachers in these other regional seminaries. That's how they're going to try and build up their leadership, and they're working very hard at it because they have very few time, because the pastors are very old. They're dying off. And the Protestant and Roman Catholic communities have to train new leadership, because there is no possibility of accepting any help from the outside in terms of, remember, the whole tradition of the three-self movement, and because of the Chinese Communist government's suspicion about Western influence and Western imperialism, the Chinese Christians have to do this on their own. So they're scrambling very fast and very hard to train leadership. The other thing that they're doing, as I indicated, is creating Christian literature. And in this process, they have a correspondence course out of the Nanjing Seminary in which they're training Sunday school teachers, the equivalent of that, in congregations all over China. And they have a correspondence course now with 10,000 people enrolled in their correspondence course, trying to train them in local congregations. The churches are filled to overflowing. It is not unusual to hear of churches that are absolutely packed with people standing outside in the streets, listening through the doors and windows that are open. David Vickner went back to his hometown where he was born, where his grandparents were missionaries and where his parents were missionaries. And he went back there for Christmas Eve. It was a wonderful time of reunion. And he found this, here it was, the middle of the winter in Hunan province, which is very cold there. Think of being out in the Nebraska prairie, and then you get an idea of what it's like in the middle of the winter. And the church windows were open, the church doors were open, because the church was absolutely jammed with people, and there were crowds of people on the outside. We found this to be true in Nanjing when we went to St. Paul's Church on Easter Sunday morning and celebrated Easter Sunday with them, and we saw these people, most of them older people, but a significant number of younger people. The middle generation is missing. The congregations we saw, they're older people and younger people. Some of these older people had set out for church that morning at 3 o'clock a.m. because they had to walk many, many miles and then catch a bus, travel to here, and then wait for another bus to travel there, to wait for another bus to get to Nanjing, to then get the local bus to get to the church. That sort of thing is going on all the time. Christians traveling for miles and at great personal effort just to be with the congregation. In this, at Nanjing, there it was Easter Sunday morning, all the Easter hymns being sung, and there we were from all these different national backgrounds singing these hymns with tears rolling down our faces as we thought of our solidarity with these Christians in China and remembering the suffering that they went through and feeling a sense of something of the power of the resurrection that has managed to keep the Chinese church alive through these very difficult times. And in fact, not only keep it alive, but to make it strong. And that's what the Chinese leaders have said, that the pain and the suffering and the difficulties through which Chinese Christians passed in the last several decades has only deepened the sense of what it means to be a Christian and has actually brought about a transformation of the Christian presence and the Christian mission in China, which has been an enriching one, because now it doesn't depend upon Western money, Western help, Western involvement in medicine and education. Medicine and education are taken care of by the government. But there it is, the personal testimony of one person to another, one individual to another, witnessing to their faith. And we heard stories of how people would maintain their contact with the gospel in those difficult years. Little groups meeting together, very carefully, very secretly most of the time, in each other's homes. So it'd just be sort of an extended family gathering, or it'd be seemingly just two families getting together that were friends. And then quietly, they would have their own service. Their Bibles were gone, but they would remember passages from memory and write them out on slips of paper, and they would pass those and duplicate them, pass them back and forth. Some would remember hymns from memory and would sing them and teach them to others that didn't know them. And they would have prayer together. Very simple service, just Bible study, a sharing of experience, singing of a hymn, prayer. That was the pattern of these house churches, as they were called. And millions of Christians emerging out of that experience of the house church and treasuring it still to this day, but now hungry for public gathering and hearing a former Lutheran pastor, I have to say former because now there are no denominations in China. It's a post-denominational situation. But a former Lutheran pastor in Shenzhen, when I was there with on a retreat with the Evangelical Lutheran Church of Hong Kong, talking about how he would celebrate the Holy Communion and people would be there kneeling, the tears streaming down their cheeks as they receive the Holy Communion, saying, "This is the first time I have been able to commune in 40 years." And how powerful that is now that they can have this corporate life together. They're still very much concerned to have the wider Chinese community and especially the Chinese government know that they are loyal Chinese who love their country, that they are not just the instruments of Western imperialism, that Christianity has a capacity to speak transculturally, and that you are able to be a Christian in the midst of a Marxist country. The same sort of thing that Herb Brokering was talking about the church in East Germany and in Poland. They know that they are in a precarious situation, they have to be very careful, and they still will not accept help from the outside. But one thing has surfaced, and I will leave this information here for you at the conclusion of our time together. There has come into being in the last few years a special committee. It's called the Amity Foundation, A-M-I-T-Y, the Amity Foundation. The Amity Foundation is sponsored by Christians, but it includes within its board and its membership non-Christians, including active members of the Communist Party. And the Amity Foundation exists as the equivalent of Lutheran Social Services. It exists as an outreach of the church that is concerned about the life and welfare of people in the wider society. And they have taken on special projects, bit by bit as they can. They are funded by the contributions of Chinese Christians. But the Chinese government has allowed them now to accept contributions from overseas. That's how the World Bible Society was able to get that printing plant built in Nanjing. So that is one of their projects. Another project is a nutritional project for the nursery and kindergartens in the Nanjing metropolitan area, in which they train nutritionists to help prepare the lunches for children, make sure children get good nutrition. Another one is care of handicapped children, in which these Christians are providing special services, including buying several vans to transport handicapped children around. Again, this is in the Nanjing area. They're gradually moving out from that area, but that's a Christian center, so that's why the Amity Foundation tends to be focused there. Another project is establishing and funding a factory for building artificial limbs for people who have lost their limbs. And the Christians are the ones who are sponsoring this factory. Another one was, there was a terrible typhoon in Guangdong province in the south, and the communist government actually admitted that they had a disaster. The Amity Foundation said, let us see if we can find outside assistance. The Chinese government said, go ahead. They called upon Christians outside of China to, if they wanted to help typhoon victims through the Amity Foundation, and money came in from Hong Kong and from many other places overseas into China to help typhoon victims. This is the presence of a way in which you and I can actually do something to assist our Chinese brothers and sisters, not in maintaining their own churches, but to participate in something of their wider outreach of Christian mission in the midst of the People's Republic of China. Well, this is a brief overview. Let's see if you have any questions that I might be able to answer before we turn to the slides and you get a chance to take a peek at some of these things. How do they reach the Chinese government? Through the Three Self movement, which emerges up out of the ranks of the Christian people. There is a whole committee. In fact, you'll see some of them in the slides. There's some of the slides that are missing. I have slides. We were in the Three Self headquarters in Shanghai. These are church leaders that are elected out of the ranks of the Protestant community, and heading them all is a very wise and highly educated Anglican bishop. Used to be an Anglican bishop, Bishop Deng is the chairman of the Three Self movement. He also is chairman of the China Christian Council. The China Christian Council is sort of the self-governing of the church within its own ranks. The Three Self movement is communication to the government and to the wider society. China Christian Council is inter-church relations and governance. They have not yet created a united Protestant church in China. There's some hope that that might happen, but they don't feel the time is right yet, because you're dealing with Christians who are everything from Baptists to Pentecostalists to Anglicans, Presbyterians, Congregationalists, Lutherans, Seventh-day Adventists, you name it, they're there. And a wide variety of doctrine, wide variety of practice, and how to create a unified church or a coordinated church out of this incredible variety of tradition and practice and doctrine is a major problem. But the China Christian Council tries to coordinate the life of these congregations as they're springing up all over China, as I said, at the rate of one a day. So there are several thousand Protestant churches and several thousand Roman Catholic churches that are open at this time. They ask for no assistance. They are determined to maintain this pattern. They know that their survival depends upon their maintaining their total Chinese character and not be seen. No. In fact, they plead with Americans, especially American Protestants, not to keep trying to smuggle Bibles into China. They say, please don't do this. We're printing Bibles. The Chinese government is helping us to print the Bibles. We'll get them to people. But when you start doing this, you are seen as being hostile to, you make Christians be seen as hostile to the government, as being totally foreign and alien, and all the problems that Christianity has had in China, and being seen as a Western reality and not as a global reality, that's being exacerbated by fundamentalist American Protestants who try to smuggle Bibles into China all the time. Don't do it, please. If you want to help us, don't do it. But one way in which you can help the mission of the church there is through the Amity Foundation, which in fact is printing Bibles, among other things. So that at least is a channel that is open for Christians here. Another project the Amity Foundation sponsors is the teaching of English and German in universities and technical colleges throughout China. In many ways, this is the way in which people from the churches, we have ALC and LCA and LCMS people over in China right now teaching English. There also, we met a Lutheran young man from Germany who's teaching German. And they're active church people and who give their own private witness and who show up in the local congregation. I mean, there they were at St. Paul's Church in Nanjing on Easter Sunday morning. There they are, and that's their part of their witness and of their presence, so they can teach English. You can do that. You can send people over there, not as missionaries, but as teachers of English. You can send money to the Amity Foundation and help that way. But the Chinese church is determined it will, in fact, be self-governing, self-supporting, and self-propagating, self-witnessing. So we don't know how it's going to go, but what's interesting is that the church this time has not died out in China. In fact, it's now flourishing. Now, that's a drop in the bucket. You know, a couple of million Christians is next to nothing in a country of 1 billion people. There are far more Muslims in China. There are 40 million Muslims ethnically, 17 million of them actively worshiping in the mosques. So there are more Muslims in China than Christians. But nevertheless, Christian presence is there. But they have to try to continue to move in such a way that they outlive their reputation of being Western and imperialistic in character.
I got the impression of the Chinese government that it's not a bit like the Russian government. In many ways, they don't suppress the people or do what they. So when we think of China and their government, it's not communism like it is in Russia.
Yeah, that's right. I know that. We have trouble with this. We tend to label everything and put it into neat little categories. So if you're Marxist, you're obviously kind of Marxist-Leninist. And if you're Marxist-Leninist, you're obviously the Russian version of that. And if you're the Russian version of that, you're obviously the Stalin version of that. Without seeing the rich variety and the differences that exist, and the fact that the Chinese and the Russians are at a point of great tension. I mean, the Chinese are more worried about the Russians than they are about the Americans. So it's hard for us to understand that, but that is so. And what you indicate about the Chinese pattern of things being different from the Russian pattern of things is quite true. They're encouraging decentralization. They're encouraging local voluntary self-development and self-direction. I remember the ALC sent a delegation over there that included a very conservative Republican wealthy farmer from North Dakota who went out to see a commune. And to be sure, it was a model commune. But he saw how it operated. And the people there made their own, it was the village system, which is indigenously Chinese. The village was incorporated as a commune. The village got together and they elected their own leaders, and then they also decided what they were going to plant and what they thought would probably bring a good price and so forth, and with the profit from last year, how they would invest it, would they buy the medium-sized tractor or would they build a school for the children and so forth and so on. And this North Dakota farmer took a look and said, why, this isn't communism, this is democratic capitalism. Well, you know, labels, the point is not the labels, but what in fact is happening, and I think that's quite right. The Chinese are also very cautious because their whole history has been a very turbulent one, where there's been a lot of power from Beijing, wherever the capital was, and then there's been a shift, a radical shift. So they're cautious. Well, regionally there are problems, and that's where the Three Self movement is very important. Because what they try to do is, because of their strong contacts with the government in Beijing, in fact, the reason we didn't meet Bishop Deng was because he was at the People's Congress in Beijing. And when we got to Beijing, there was the People's Congress. You can see pictures of it here where they're streaming out of the Great Hall of the People for lunch. And so it's very important to maintain that official contact in Beijing. On the basis of that, then they can go to regional groupings and they can say, you're giving Christians in this area or in this city or in this village a very hard time. But this is what is happening from Beijing, and this is what the Religious Affairs Bureau in Beijing has now said, and calling attention to the new Chinese constitution in which religious freedom is even more liberal than under the old constitution, and trying to then quietly, and in the very Chinese way, you don't pressure in China, you kind of work quietly, quietly and yet persistently trying to bring about changes regionally. And that, in fact, is happening. But there are some regions of China where there are some people still very hostile to the church and still are very repressive of Christians. But increasingly, that is changing. And that's why there are churches opening every day in China, because one region after another begins to become liberalized. So that's where the three-self movement is very important as a liaison between the Chinese government and the Christian community. And so we can only hope and pray that their work continues to move ahead. And you hear in certain fundamentalist circles here in the United States about, well, that's the apostate church and the real church is suppressed. Don't be taken in by that. This is not an apostate church. These are faithful, devout, and highly educated and articulate Christians. And the so-called suppressed house churches you hear about usually are these rather strange Pentecostalist, charismatic, strange groups that have no identification or continuity with any kind of traditional Christianity, most usually, where there's no education, there's no catechesis, there are no trained clergy, and you have some of these rather exotic indigenous Chinese group like the Little Flock of Jesus and other sorts of groups just off on their own and refusing to have anything to do with the China Christian Council or the Three Self Church. So don't be taken in by that.